Greetings, Earth explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio, my fellow Earth explorers. It is so nice to have you here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State near the Canadian and Idahoan borders. The solar wind tonight is 441.6 kilometers per second, and the sun is absolutely blank today. No sunspots. However, there is a solar wind stream flowing from the coronal hole on the sun. Should reach Earth on May 27th or May 28th. So those will be your best days for an aurora borealis. The Mars landing of the Phoenix lander should happen today, if it hasn't happened already. It's looking like 4:53 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time. I don't have an update yet, but of all the spacecraft sent to Mars in the 50-year history of the space age, about half have crashed, skipped off the atmosphere, failed to enter a proper orbit, or missed the planet entirely. The good news is the other half succeeded. And we'll probably let you know before the end of the program if the Phoenix probe landed on time and without issue. You know, a major quake such as the one that left at least 60,000 dead in southwestern China this month can trigger other earthquakes halfway around the world, according to a study released today. This unexpected finding could one day help make better predictions about the frequency and intensity of aftershocks. A team of geologists in the United States found that 12 out of 15 major quakes registering a magnitude of 7.0 or higher since 1990 generated surface waves that set off smaller seismic events in fault systems on distant continents. We're not really sure if that works in our continent yet, because we had over 1,000 quakes in about a 10-day period off the coast of Oregon, and then we've had a very strange pattern of quakes in Reno, Nevada recently, where the quakes started out small and got larger and larger. And it's exactly the opposite of the normal pattern that we see. The last 2 weeks, we had open lines here at X Squared Radio. We wanted to talk to the other world experts, you. And tonight we will leave the phone lines open all program, but we do have a very special guest tonight. He is an author, lecturer, and guide. He delivered a seismic shock to archaeologists and archaeology around the world in the early 1990s when he and Boston University geologist Robert Schock revealed that the Great Sphinx of Giza showed evidence of rainfall erosion. Such erosion could only mean that the Sphinx was carved during or before the rains that marked the transition of northern Africa from the last ice age to the present interglacial epoch, a transition that occurred in the millennia from 10,000 to 5,000 B.C., a long time before the Egyptians got there. My guest tonight is John Anthony West, and we would like to welcome him tonight. All right. How are you, John?
I am fine. Thank you, Brooke.
Well, it's a real pleasure to have you on the program tonight. I have a great affinity for Egypt, as do our listeners, and many of them have either wanted to go on a tour or some have even been on a tour with a guide of some kind or another, and I know you've been doing it for several years. How long have you been running tours to Egypt?
About 25 years, actually.
25 years. Now, I know you don't take a large group to Egypt.
No, that would ruin it.
Just small groups, so very few of our listeners have been out there.
An absolute max of 30, but I prefer it around 20.
Yeah, 20 is a negotiable group when you're making your way through Egypt. I think more than a busload is kind of hard to get around.
Well, a bus actually holds more than 50, so...
Wow!
So a busload... A busload is a load of people, and
my goodness.
They can't get into a lot of the places, and you can't talk to 50 people at once. But around 20, everybody moves, and in fact, 20 is kind of an ideal number, because if it's too small, it can get a bit incestuous, even though the logistics are better. But 20, there's always intelligent people with expertise in related fields one way or another, and there's a lot of feedback and interchange and discussion, so 20 works best.
Yeah, and there are a lot of places to see in Egypt. You just can't fit more than 20 people in there.
Right, yeah. A number of the sort of constricted tombs and chambers and things like that. But 20 works.
Well, John, what got you started in archaeology?
Well, that's a long story, and I don't think I want to take up the 3 hours with it, but... But
well, what did you start out doing? What switched
you
over?
In a nutshell, no, I didn't start doing that at all. Actually, I started as a novelist and playwright and screenwriter, and had a lot of things published and done, none of which ever made any money. Otherwise, I wouldn't have allowed myself to get dragooned into Egyptology and archaeology. But briefly, I knew when I was very young, 12 or 13 years old, that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum. Everybody else called it progress, but I regarded it as absolutely insane. And the objective to begin with, when I decided I wanted to be the little boy who said the emperor has no clothes and convince everyone that the world was crazy, and started out doing, for the most part, satiric plays and novels and things. But gradually, through a series of, call them coincidences, but I'd rather prefer to call them epiphanies, I became aware that what we live in, the asylum, is not really progress, it's regress, and that in the very distant past, people knew better, and they knew that life had a meaning, And they expressed that knowledge in, for the most part, in sacred art and architecture that was still accessible. You walk into Chartres Cathedral, and whatever you may think of the medieval era, and I wouldn't want to live back then either, somebody knew something to produce that extraordinary building and the other Gothic cathedrals. And anyway, through a long series of, again, called them coincidences, but I prefer not to call them that, I became aware of the work of an extraordinary Russian, really Armenian teacher, George Gurdjieff, and that in turn led me into something solid, that history is a con job, that we've been fed something that is not in fact the case. We think that you learn in school and you learn nothing but that progress is that we're the most advanced people that ever lived on this earth, with our hydrogen bombs and our striped toothpaste and our bobblehead dolls, and everything before us was more or less primitive, and we're further advanced than they were. But let's say you don't have to be specifically religious to understand the truth of by their fruits you shall know them. So we have our hydrogen bombs and bobblehead dolls, and they had their cathedrals and their Egyptian temples and so on. And through, again, looks like fortuitous. I wasn't actually specifically looking for it. It just showed up. And when it showed up, something deep and internal said, oh, yes, that is correct. And through my interest in these things, eventually I started doing my first nonfiction book, which was about astrology, actually, called A Case for Astrology. Putting together all of the evidence that says there's something to it. And in doing the research for that, now we're talking back in the 60s, I came across the work of this extraordinary genius, French, Alsatian really, with the unpronounceable name R.A. Schwalla-Delubich. And that was a book that was in the British Museum. I was living in England at the time, and the pages hadn't even been cut in the old days, not now, but French books, they came out in paperback, and yeah, you had to cut the pages yourself. So this book had been there for 10 years. It was first published in 57, and the pages weren't even cut. I was the first one to access it, and my French at that time was not great, but it was good enough to just leafing through to realize that this guy had actually done it. I mean, he had demonstrated what was accepted as common knowledge through the Renaissance and earlier, that Egypt was the fount of ancient wisdom. And of course, we're taught the opposite. Yes, they were marvelous, the temples, wonderfully architecturally and artistically accomplished, but really they were primitives, and real civilization started with the Greeks. And I realized this was not the case, and that Schwaller had actually put together in two enormous volumes, one volume of photographs, but two enormous volumes of text, he had reformulated the ancient sacred science, but in a manner accessible to our rationalized Western intellects. And that, in turn, led to writing a book about Schwaller, The Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt. And in doing the research for that, in one of Schwaller's other volumes, that's the masterwork, The Temple of Man, now available in an English translation, brilliant in English translation, actually, but pretty impenetrable. Schwaller is not an easy read.
When you went to Egypt to get the information to write Serpent in the Sky, you went to some of the ancient sites, which I imagine in those days were not as accessible by tourists as they are today. Maybe they might have been in disrepair, but
what
did you learn? Were they in good shape when you went back?
Actually, in many ways, they had less amenities. You couldn't find a toilet anywhere, but there were also a lot fewer tourists and a lot fewer restrictions. Now it's all security and all of that. I mean, we get around that on the trips, but it's a nuisance. And in those days, you could wander wherever you wanted. But no, they were fine. Most everything that's now available was excavated then. But of course, I had to see it for myself. And mainly what I wanted to do on that first trip was, my book, Serpent in the Sky, was written mostly in the libraries. I didn't actually need the experience of Egypt to write most of the book, but the one point that I did need to research myself, Schwaller hadn't actually done it, but he'd come out with this observation that the Great Sphinx of Giza had been weathered by water and not by wind and sand. And I realized instantly when I read that, that if you could prove that was true, you would have to revise everything we've ever been taught about very ancient history, because...
Yes, what happened to the franchise of Egypt on the Sphinx when you released that in writing, and at least did a better job at proliferating that knowledge than the author you studied?
Well, not in writing. When I developed the theory on my own, and I realized this was a matter of geology, and if you could prove that the Sphinx was weathered by water geologically, everything would have to change. And I wrote that up. I did the best that I could. I spent a lot of time in the library doing my research, but I am not a geologist. So when I published it with the serpent, I mean, basically it was ignored, and attempts to enlist geologists to back me up or prove me wrong prove futile. Either I got no answer or I got a very abusive answer. But eventually, it took about 12 years of hunting around and chasing, and again, strange circumstances led to it. I was put in touch with Robert Schock, now my good friend and colleague, who was a geologist, highly credentialed, Yale PhD in geology and geophysics at Boston University, and gradually got him interested in this. I mean, he's initially deeply skeptical. He just couldn't imagine, on the basis of the photographs that I sent him, that nobody had noticed this before, because it looked to him like classic water weathering. Anyway, again, all of this is long stories, but I got him, scraped together a bit of money to get him over to Egypt, and after a first trip, he was still speaking mainly in conditionals. It was very hard to get a declarative sentence out of him, but he was interested, and then scraped together some more money, and then enlisted a geophysicist with seismographs to go over with us, and wangled permissions, also another long story. And then once we had the permissions, they tried to rescind the permissions. We had a hell of a job. Long and short of it is that everybody was now convinced, the geologists, who were the ones who counted, not me, that we were onto something.
This is incredibly profound, because the idea that water erosion had gotten to the Sphinx means that the area had to be radically different at the time the Sphinx was carved, at least well before,
exactly.
Well after the time the Sphinx was carved, than it was then. And, you know, I know people that have come back from Egypt with petrified clams, dollar bills. So
that's a different story. That's from ancient geological times. I mean, clams don't erode very quickly. But
no.
For the Sphinx, which is carved out of what's called a competent limestone, to get water weathered means that it has to have been carved during or before the rains fell. And the rains haven't fallen to any extent in Egypt since about more or less 4,000 B.C. The Sahara is a relatively new desert. See, before 10,000 B.C. or so, before the breakup of the last ice age, Egypt is more or less like modern-day Kenya, but according to the paleoclimatologists and people who study ancient climates, there were other periods before that when there were torrential rains all over Egypt. And my reckoning is, this is a complicated issue, but my reckoning is that the Sphinx has to have been built, or carved rather, at a very distant period, and then the rains came and weathered it into the condition that it's now in. I mean, even our opponents, who are mainly the archaeologists and the Egyptologists, who, mind you, are not geologists, try to find ways in which the Sphinx could have been weathered into the condition that it's in dynastic Egypt time. In other words, from about 3000 BC on. The geologists, because we presented this evidence twice at what's effectively the Super Bowl of geology, the Geological Society of America's annual meeting, first in 1991, which then led to the big NBC special that Charlton Heston hosted and was all over the press, I mean, international news, and then again more evidence in 2000, because we'd been collecting more evidence, to the almost unanimous approval of the geologists, and they're the ones whose opinions count in this matter. But it's the archaeologists and the Egyptologists who own the playing field, so we're still deep in a battle to demonstrate once and for all that it is weathered by water, specifically precipitation-induced rainwater falling over long periods of time, which means that everything that anyone's ever been taught about really ancient history has to be completely thrown out of the window, because the Sphinx is the most spectacular sculpture on Earth. No one even would question that. And the temples around it are not gigantic by Egyptian standards, but they're built of huge blocks of stone slotted into place like building blocks, or, you know, kids' building blocks. I mean, when I say huge, 75 to 150 to 200-ton blocks. And we couldn't today. We can fly to the moon, but we'd be very hard put to build a temple of that nature today, even with our cranes and all the rest of it. Rigging it so that you could fit them into place like building blocks would be very difficult.
I understand it probably could be built today. Even 20 years ago, it could have been built. But it would have taken 10 to 15 years to build. Not the 2 years that they're saying it took, you know, 1.4 million blocks to be put into
place. But that's the pyramid. That's the Great Pyramid we're talking about, not the Sphinx.
Well, yeah, but the Sphinx was carved.
Sphinx was carved, but there's a temple right in front of it and another one adjacent to that to the south. And that's the temple. It doesn't look like much when you see it in a photograph. When you're in it, it's a really very, very powerful place. But those are the buildings that
the red granite block
was carved. An enclosure had to be, the plateau had to be carved out from around the Sphinx. In other words, it had to be quarried out because it sits below the plateau level, and the blocks that were quarried out form those two temples, and those are these gigantic blocks that, I mean, we can fly to the moon, so we could probably do it if it was in our interest to do so, but it's not in our interest to do so, and meanwhile, we couldn't do it. And so it means that at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization at all, prior to 10,000 BC, there were people in Egypt, whoever they may have been, that were capable of the feat of technology. And of course, that's the crowning achievement of contemporary society. The carving of the Sphinx itself is it's a sculpture of profound emotional power, but it's not that difficult to do. You just need genius sculptors. But the temples that are built of these gigantic stones, that's technology. And we can't do it today, but somebody way back then, even if the dynastic Egyptians did it, it's still a mystery. But if you take it back further for when it was probably built, in other words, it's built at a time when everyone is supposed to be hunter-gatherers. The geology is the geology. Unless they can disprove the water weathering hypothesis, they're stuck with a total revision of everything, because we are led to believe everything we've ever been taught. Anybody listening to this program in school has been taught that prior to 10,000 BC, there were no domesticated animals and all of this sort of thing, and it was nothing but hunter-gatherers, some of them rather accomplished, but nevertheless not capable of any kind of feats of technology, and suddenly you're faced with a real science that says, yeah,
you're gonna have to
eat it, because it means that progress is a fiction. It is a
when you're standing in front of the Sphinx and you look out in front of it, what's been excavated. Now, sure, you can see the red granite all fit together into the basement of whatever the temple was that was there. But what remains in front of that looks to me like ship docks, like somebody at some time or another was able to sail right to the front of the Sphinx and moor a boat and get off right there. If you were sailing into that area, the Sphinx would have been the first thing that you saw right there on the coast.
It's not on the coast. Actually, it's more complicated than that, Brooke. And it's hard to explain on the radio. If you're there in person, you can see it. There probably was a canal of some sort that led from the Nile. But even the Sphinx, it is cut into a hollow in the plateau, but when you approach it at the moment, you come down from the little village that's grown up in front of the pyramids into where the Sphinx lies. But with our seismographs, we were able to demonstrate that the Sphinx is actually, or in ancient times, before it was desert, it was on not exactly a cliff, but on a kind of bluff. And the Nile, the water level would have been a lot lower than it is now, maybe as much as 60 or 100 feet. So so the Sphinx would have been up, not down.
I see.
Oh yeah, it's funny. Things of this nature are tough to visualize by radio, but when you're there and you're standing in front of it, you can't miss it. I mean, you can see exactly where it is now, of course, but it's then quite easy to visualize how it must have been. But the main point, actually, to get back to it, is that if it's as old as we think it is, and we debate this because we can't demonstrate yet scientifically just how old it is, but the main point is that everything that anyone has ever been taught about the past is dead wrong, because it doesn't go from primitives to us. Who knows when the primitives were there, but whoever built the Sphinx and this extraordinary temple, these extraordinary temples around it, were not primitives, and they were quite definitely doing this amazing work at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization. You can understand, actually, I mean, the kind of flack that we take is, I mean, they're pretty abusive, our opponents. And an Air Force friend of mine says, well, the flak is always heaviest when you're right over the target. So
that's right.
It comes with the territory.
Well, let me ask you a question. You know, when you look at the granite blocks that are fit together, and some of these are just enormous, and they're pinned. It's like a key in a lock, and they had metal or poured stone keystones put in between them to hold them into place. These are very similar, and the stone cutting style is very similar to what is used in Mesoamerica, in the Yucatan area, in the Incan and Mayan construction. Now, I'm not talking about the volcanic mortar. I'm talking about the giant granite, gray granite blocks that are machined so closely that you can't fit a piece of paper between them. It's
yes.
The same thing in Egypt. Now, these are two different sides of the globe, approximately the same time period, 9,000 to 10,000 BC. This is supposedly the date of the last major geological cataclysm, and it could have even been a cosmological cataclysm that wiped out these great civilizations. What are people saying when you start adding evidence from the other side of the world to your story?
Well, again, all of these things are complicated. The granite blocks that you're looking at, if you're referring to the ones around the Sphinx, those are facing stones, actually, and we are absolutely convinced that the inner blocks, the gigantic blocks, are actually limestone, and they're faced with these big granite blocks. It's the granite blocks that look like the stuff in Tiwanaku and Machu Picchu and Mesoamerica. So we think there's some connection there, but the granite blocks around the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple are a second level stage of construction. In other words, the huge, I mean, gigantic limestone blocks that make up the core masonry are coeval with the Sphinx and predate even the granite. So we're talking about two stages of construction.
Wow.
The limestone blocks, even older, and the granite ones, we don't know when those were done. But they're not identical to what you see in Mesoamerica, but they're close enough so that you get a sense of, let's say, an architectural continuity, that there's some relationship between them. Trouble is you can't demonstrate, you can't prove that. What you can prove is the water weathering. You could see stylistic similarities, which are, of course, important, but since nobody knows when those Mesoamerican temples were built either, or how they were built either, because
right,
they're up
right.
in these huge mountains, and nobody can figure out, A, why they bothered to put them up there, B, how they actually got them up there, and C, what they should do them in this amazing fashion of 17 and 14-sided blocks. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. The Egyptian granite is not as complex, but there's a real stylistic similarity, and it's hard to imagine that two things that similar or two styles that similar should evolve absolutely independently. There's some connection back somewhere or another, but we are talking about two stages of construction, and it's the giant limestone core masonry that's even older. So, again, it's a mystery compounded upon mystery.
Well, we see a very similar thing in Abydos, where you see Seti's temple, which is fairly modern by, you know, dynastic timelines. And then underneath it and to the side of it is the Osirian, which is not of that technology, much higher, much more advanced technology, older. And we're talking enormous red granite blocks hauled down probably 300 miles from Aswan.
Oh, yeah.
And fit together and then destroyed or blown apart or buried in the sand.
Yeah, we don't know.
SETI's engineers went out to find it. What do you make of that?
Well, more or less what you say, that SETI was building his temple, and he didn't know that the Osirian was there either, and suddenly ran across this. This again, everything that we talk about is complicated, so we only have a certain amount of time, and radio is a wonderful medium, but it's not visual, and it's hard to visualize these things. But my reckoning is that SETI was moving building his own temple back, and suddenly came upon this ruinous structure, probably completely ruined. It may have been rebuilt virtually in its entirety by SETI, because there are anomalies in that building. But the style, I mean, style tells you, in architectural history, when you see two different styles incorporated in the same building, you know for sure that you're talking about two different time periods. And the style, the stark, bare granite, huge blocks, has nothing to do with what was going on in the New Kingdom around 1300 BC when SETI was building his temple. So my reckoning is that he came across this thing and just stopped work, shifted the plan of his old temple around, perhaps rebuilt the entire Osirion, but understood that this, you know, he didn't know what it was for either, but recognized it as a magnificent, very ancient, sacred structure, but there's no writing about it. He didn't know either. And there it sits. And when you see the two together, when we're there, which of course we go to on the trips, and you go through SETI's temple, which is one of the highest expressions of New Kingdom art and sculpture, relief work, it's just gorgeous in there. And then suddenly you get in the back, and you see this amazing, stark, resonating structure with these giant granite columns and no inscriptions and nothing that says anything. And you get a sense when you're there that this, whoever did this, it was a different mindset and a different level of understanding than even what was going on in SETI's time, which was one of the high periods of New Kingdom art and architecture in Egypt. So,
well, let me ask you a question about that.
There's no way to convey that in X number of words.
Right. But you can see that in one case, you know, SETI is building an edifice for religious practice, and he butts it up against, by accident or on purpose, it's hard to tell, but it's clear that he altered the architecture of his temple to be L-shaped in order to go around it and incorporate it.
And then
you have this other structure of a very high engineering feat without a single mark on it. It's clear that one was religious and the other one had some kind of purpose. Do you think the purpose was religious or scientific?
Religious is a purpose too. But it's a different purpose. Actually, with Egypt, something like the Osirion or the pyramids themselves, which again are a very complicated question, but when you're inside those pyramids, Great Pyramid, Red Pyramid, especially in Giza, it's very hard to avoid the sense that you're in some kind of a gigantic instrument, but a religious instrument. And in Egypt, you can say Egypt is in a sense difficult. Easy to define in the sense that you can say it is a one-purpose civilization. 3,500 years of it is devoted to a single purpose, which is the immortality of the soul, the development of the immortality within us. I mean, this was the Egyptian belief, and my understanding of it is Egyptian knowledge. If you read Egyptology and archaeology, They say the Egyptians believe this and the Egyptians believe that. It never, ever occurs to them that, hey, maybe the Egyptians knew, and it's you guys who believe because you no longer understand what was involved in building structures of this nature. And my sense of it is that the Osirion is equally religious, but in a different way. It didn't, it's not, you don't see pictures of specific ceremonies that are going on or anything like that. And that when you're there, you get a sense of, when you're in the, by the Sphinx in the valley, what's so-called, the call, they called the Valley Temple of Khafra, there's a resonance. You walk into this place and you are tuned to it as though you're in a gigantic stone instrument, musical instrument of some sort. So that's also religious, but it's not, it's a different order and kind of religion, but it's, neither of them are superstition. It's just that one is, to a certain extent at least, a bit familiar to us, whereas the Osirion and the pyramids actually are 100% mysterious. You walk in there and you, excuse me, you, it's an intensely emotional experience, but it's also very mystifying because you get this sense that you're in this enormous, emotionally tuned, resonating instrument, but what for? We don't know.
All yes, exactly. I mean, there really is no writing inside the pyramid that says this
no.
is for this and this is for that and do this first and do that first, but
right.
there's no denying that there's some kind of energy there that does resonate, even for those that are as spiritual as a stone. But, you know, you've used the word, you know, religious instrument many times. I would maybe counter that and say maybe it's a spiritual instrument, that it somehow connects with another dimension of the human being itself and tries to awaken something that's perhaps eternal and not so 3D. And that's
yes.
sometimes difficult
right.
for us to tap into, and there's been, I'm sure, scores of books written upon it, but the point is, look at the gross national product that was used to machine granite and limestone, and these are incredibly hard rocks.
Well, the granite is, not the limestone.
Well, yeah, but some of the lime, some of the stones that are put on there, the facing stones, are much harder than bronze, that's for sure. Historians would have us believe that the people that lived in the area at that time only had copper tools. And
oh, yeah. Oh, yes, this is what they think. Oh, we don't know. How they did this stuff, we absolutely don't know. And, yeah, but limestone's fairly soft. When you you can chop up limestone without too much difficulty. When you're in 200-ton blocks, that's a problem. But when you're dealing with granite and acres of granite, that has to come down from Aswan, which is 600 miles
right.
south of the Giza Plateau, and then they're chopping this up into, in the case of the Great Pyramid, in certain cases above the King's Chamber, 70-ton blocks. I mean, how they did it is unknown. Why they did it is doubly unknown, because why should you go to this amount of trouble unless you have some very good reason for doing so? And when you are there, I often say, when I start off my trips, I say to people that, you know, Egypt is like sex. Until you can read all about it and you look at pictures and watch videos, but until you've experienced it, you really haven't a clue what it's about. You can read from
true.
Now till doomsday, but when you're there, and in these places, and you go, again, with the proper kind of attitude and without the crowds being there and all that sort of thing, you're confronted with a civilization that is to us impenetrable. I mean, we really, you feel it. I mean, you feel that you're in the presence of the gods, quite literally. I mean, of supernatural forces and supernatural human beings capable of doing this amazing stuff, but for reasons that we can't really put words to, but we can experience. you when you're there. You get it. And you've done your homework, I can see, in the couple of days since I talked to you. You've read a lot of stuff.
Some people would ask, if they're so advanced, if they're so superhuman, if they're so extraordinary, why stone? Why didn't they leave it behind? Why stone? Why rock? Why didn't they do it out of metal? Why didn't they do it out of glass or crystal? Why stone? Why did they go through all the trouble to machine stone?
Well, they apparently didn't, as far as we know, they did not have an advanced metallurgy. You know, I mean, the Bronze Age comes much later than the pyramids. Yeah, they had bits and pieces of meteoric iron. But also, why stone? I don't know either, except that the stone has, let's say, the stone has certain properties. In Egypt, wood actually is very rare. Stone was all over the place. Wood was a problem. You have to import it from Lebanon. But
see, I think that's exactly the right answer. I think granite and alabaster and limestone have certain electrical and magnetic properties that resonate exactly right with the earth, so that it will connect it to a human soul.
That's right. Yes, something of that nature. There's a symbolism of stone. I mean, they use stone not for architectural purposes and not just for aesthetic purposes. I mean, granite is used, we don't know why exactly, but there's a reason why they build sometimes in granite or incorporate granite into limestone and use alabaster in a place where you wouldn't expect them to use it, on floors, and for example. And alabaster is a rather soft stone, so if you're doing a floor, you think you'd want the hardest stone, but no, it's sandstone for other reasons, and sometimes they're using stones for no particular reason that we can determine, that have to come from a long way away, and not using the stuff that's nearby. So it's just, wherever you turn, it's mysteries, and very often all you can say with certainty is that the standard answers that you get from the Egyptologists and the archaeologists are dead wrong, because they're looking at it from their point of view. I mean, they're concerned with how much of what we know, and we, of course, know the most, and the best, how much of what we know they knew. And this is quite incorrect. Much more important to look at it and say, well, we haven't a clue why they did what they did, but in order to go to this much trouble to build at this, with this, in this kind of magnitude, with that kind of precision, they have to have had a good reason for it. It's not just superstition or belief or fantasy. They're putting fabulous amounts of work that we can't reproduce today for some damn good reason of their own that we don't know. So you go at it, if you have any intelligence, with a sense of humility of saying, who were these amazing people that do these things that even if we don't understand them, they move us sometimes to tears. I mean, Egypt is a very emotional experience. And if you have your wits about you, you look to them for new knowledge rather than look to see how much of what we know they knew. But the further you go with Egyptology, the clearer it becomes that a lot of what we knew, that what we know, they also knew. And now I'm talking about the sciences. I mean, it's now pretty demonstrable that behind those strange myths and stories, not just of Egypt, but of other ancient civilizations as well, is a cosmology and an astronomical knowledge that's consonant with our own, except that they expressed it in myth and symbol rather than in mathematical formula.
Yeah.
But it's there now. I mean, the last 20 years has brought, I'm not responsible for it, as it were, but the whole Sphinx business has been a great, it's almost set off in its own way, a kind of a cottage industry of really very erudite and knowledgeable inquiries into the separate aspects of these many mysteries.
Well, it's clear that the franchise, the tourist business of busing people to and from the pyramids to show it off, is on the downside of interest. I think in, you know, for the last 153 or 54 years since the science of archaeology came about, people have been flying or busing or cameling over to the pyramids, and And it's clear almost to the casual observer now that all this existed before there ever was an Egypt, before the first pharaoh ever was, you know, came to power. So you would think that the misnomer, the misinterpretation of, or let's just call it realizing that the earth is round instead of flat, at some point the leaders of Egypt have to say, okay, what we have here really is evidence of an even more ancient and more advanced civilization, and we want to really investigate this, and we want to revitalize our tourist industry and get them interested in the truth and not keep suppressing all of the wonderful discoveries that are being made by, as you say, very erudite, very educated people that are now coming to the pyramids for really armchair archaeology, but they're scientists, and they're making remarkable discoveries.
Yeah, well, this is actually, it is a funny situation, actually. Let's say the Egyptian authorities who are responsible for that, they have, for the 150 years that there's been archaeology, they've been taking a back seat to the Western archaeologists who were determined to demonstrate that the ancient Egyptians must have been primitives because they were earlier than the Greeks, and the real civilization started with the Greeks. This is what we've all been taught in school. If you're an architect and you take architectural history, they have a couple of days, a day or two devoted to Egypt, and then the rest they get into Greece and say, oh, well, now we're talking, and then they get into Rome and so on.
Right, right.
So, but this is part of, this is a religious agenda in its own right. I call it the Church of Progress, and the central tenet of the Church of Progress, two central tenets, the one is that we're the most advanced beings that ever existed. So if you come up with demonstrations that, and you go even back before Egypt, mind you, the Egyptians themselves, the ancient Egyptians, did believe, there are a couple of chronological tablets and papyruses that talk about long prior reigns, prior to the beginnings of dynastic Egypt, when first the gods themselves ruled, and then secondly, the shadowy semi-divine beings called the followers or companions of Horus followed, and then comes dynastic Egypt. So the Egyptians themselves evidently knew that there were these long prior reigns. They even give dates of regnal years for the pharaohs, these divine beings who ruled, and this is dismissed out of hand by today's Egyptologists and archaeologists, as if they knew more about Egyptian history than the ancient Egyptians themselves. But
well, that goes back to the religion of science. I mean, you just
That's the Church
high
of Progress.
Who rule with an iron fist and PhD, and you're not messing with it.
That's right. Well, that's basically it. I mean, they make a living selling apples, and we're upsetting the apple cart. So
we're making apple juice.
Yeah. But this is true, but a lot of it is this actually quasi-religious conviction that we are the most advanced beings that ever were. And when you get to Egypt after a couple of weeks there, you realize that everything you've been taught is a complete load of baloney. And you see, I mean, this is a really interesting lesson. You really see what a real civilization was like. And even that, what I hope will be my next book, is called Consider the Kali Yuga, subtitled 2012 and all that, going into the whole notion of the yugas and the history as a cycle, that it's a big mystery. That, I mean, even the Egyptologists acknowledge that Egypt, dynastic Egypt we're talking about, was at its height at its very beginning, and what was going on before that. The pyramids, what you see now, is mostly genuinely Old Kingdom work, but it's superimposed upon, and this is quite demonstrable, upon remains, something that was there much earlier. Probably the whole thing was, whenever the Sphinx went up, the original pyramids. We don't actually know if they're pyramids, but the original structures that subsequently became the pyramids was there from the get-go back, who knows when, thousands and thousands and thousands of years, and that is, from certain architectural standpoints and maybe even artistic standpoints, superior even to what went on over the course of dynastic Egypt, which is amazing enough. And what went on in dynastic Egypt was at its height, very close to its beginning, and then degenerated finally into the kind of Greco-Roman period, and then ultimately Rome took over and Egypt disappeared as an independent country. But you can watch...
I think that's what people see, is that they see that at least the leaders, the pharaohs and those close to them, at least the early ones, had some idea how great the previous civilizations were, and that they had
yes.
some kind of doorway or a stargate or something that
yep.
they could connect the soul to the hereafter and without dying. I mean, you could do it while you were alive. But they didn't share the knowledge with the general public. It was private among them, and when they died off, it died with them.
I'm not so sure of that. I think if you ask the right questions, it was available to all. I mean, the pharaoh was an absolute ruler in a sense, but he was the prototype of the potentially divine human being, and probably if he did his homework and did his work, he was such a character, because you don't keep a civilization going through 3,500 years by tyranny and by force. So
yeah, that's true.
So
that's
Egypt
true,
was yeah. like, it's like saying now, you know, that a symphony orchestra is only open to accomplished musicians. Well, it is, but if you do your homework, it doesn't matter if you come from the ghetto, you have the talent and you have the discipline, you can become a concert musician or a
right.
professional baseball player. We have instances of this now, but we don't apply it to philosophy and religion and intellectual affairs and that sort of thing. But if you pay your dues, you become one of the elite. It's not that it's a closed hierarchy. And later on, when it degenerates, then it becomes hereditary. But earlier on, no, the pharaoh was hereditary, yes. And that gets into very interesting questions about the validity of keeping certain bloodlines pure. But now, coming out of DNA research and all of that sort of thing, and the breakthrough science, it's becoming clear. I don't have it exactly clear in my own head, but there are now good reasons why the bloodline is transmitted through the female side. I forget, it has some mitochondrial DNA or something like that gets passed on pure by the mother. So as long as the mother comes from a pure bloodline, the children will always have, I think it's 50% of their DNA. However it works, the line continues, whereas if you break that line, and Judaism still goes that way. I mean, you're Jewish if your mother's Jewish. Your mother has to be Jewish, doesn't matter what your father is. And so the line continues. And this was common knowledge. I mean, this was a practice very common in the very ancient world. And for the most part, I mean, I take it almost as a given when looking at very, very ancient civilizations that if I don't understand why they're doing, it's because I don't understand, not because they didn't know what they were doing.
Well, I mean, there's plenty of evidence of this. If you just look in the New Testament alone, by the time you get to the book of Luke, you see that Mary, Jesus' mother, they very rarely and very specially name her genealogy, 14 generations, to come up with Mary, and then Jesus is born of Mary. So this lineage, this pure bloodline, is absolutely imperative to get the right being. Now,
that's right.
The interesting thing is, a couple of months after he's born, where do they move? Egypt,
yeah.
And he probably lived there until he left to travel east, and then returned back when he was 29 years old to Jerusalem. So,
yes.
He was exposed to all this high technology. He was exposed as a youth to all of this divine being science, let's call it that, for his whole life. And he became the prototype. He became the expert model, as it were, the savior himself. And that's what I think, maybe, in my opinion, all the pharaohs were trying to be. And maybe they didn't have the bloodline, didn't have the training, didn't have some pieces missing or whatever it was, but Jesus was the one that accomplished it.
Well, maybe. That's another labyrinth of controversial scholarship.
That's a good one, and we'll get into it in our next hour.
because most of what is associated with doctrinal Christianity comes directly out of Egypt. It's out of the Isis, Horus, Osiris cycle, except
exactly.
that in Egypt, it's mythology, which doesn't mean that it's a lie. Myth is usually used as something is a myth. That means it's a falsehood or a lie or a made-up story. Really, it isn't. Myth is the dramatization of the interplay of cosmic principles.
Right.
And virtually everything that you associate with doctrinal Christianity, everything except the bigotry and the intolerance and the torture, comes out of Egypt. And I think it was a mistake of the Christian church, actually, to make it as though it were a historical story. I mean, you know this probably. I mean, I see you're really well read in this stuff. You cannot actually prove, from a scholarly point of view, that there was a living Jesus Christ. I mean, in Egypt, he's the Pharaoh. He's the Horus on earth. It comes directly out of Egypt. Gurdjieff, I'm sure you're familiar with Gurdjieff, when asked about Egypt, said it was esoteric Christianity. And when you're in Egypt, you see at Ptolemaic times, you see 300 years before Christianity arises, virtually everything that you associate with Christianity, the Immaculate Conception and the birth of Horus, of the Virgin Isis becomes the Virgin Mary, and there may have been such a person. I'm not in a position to say yes or no, but the scholarship that's involved with this complex argument is very intriguing and quite extensive, and there are a lot of good books out there. I mean, really very careful scholars over the last couple of hundred years who are arguing that there may not even have been such a person in the flesh, but rather that they appropriated the myth wholesale and made it historical. I don't know. I mean, I'm open to that interpretation, but I'm also open to the possibility that there was such a person who, one way or another, either actually consciously lived the myth, or at some point, shortly thereafter, had the myth grafted onto him. Because if you look at the parallels between the Egyptian Isis-Horus cycle and read the Gospels and see what the story of Jesus is supposed to be, it's the same myth. I mean, all of the same characters
one,
are there,
one
except they're historical.
The other by,
I don't
by
know.
Quite a ways. So
what?
let's get into this in the next hour. We've got about four minutes of commercials.
Oh, okay.
And, after 4 minutes of commercials, we'll come back and we'll investigate this opening a little bit more.
Oh, thanks. This is fun. I'm enjoying this.
Absolutely. My guest is
John Anthony West.
We'll be back after this.
Thanks, bud. Thanks, Dick. I'm on hold here.
You bet.
What do you mean?
What? The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first
volume.
The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack.
Oh.
They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean, a really good telescope.
Oh, yeah?
Well,
oh, yeah.
At the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping.
Cool.
They have come a long way,
yeah.
You know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs.
Sure.
There is no better way to view the sun than the Coronado Sky.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
Well, that's a bit complicated.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. Now, we're so glad that you're here with us this evening. Beautiful spring day in eastern Washington State up against the Canadian border and the Idaho border. And it looks like the Phoenix lander has landed safely. It has survived its harrowing descent to Mars and apparently stands poised to conduct what scientists hope will be a revealing investigation of the Red Planet's enigmatic northern plains. During the final minutes of the descent, team members and spectators alike were riveted by the running commentary provided by Deputy Systems Engineer Richard Kornfeld in the mission support area at NASA's Jet Propulsion Labs in Pasadena, California. The initial data from Phoenix bodes very well for the mission, as the lander appears to lie just 25 degrees from horizontal. Actually, that's a quarter of a degree from horizontal. That suggests that it did not land on top of a boulder, which could have caused the probe to topple over or tumble down a steep slope, which could have put its two solar panels at an unfavorable angle in the low-light conditions of the Martian Arctic. Without the panels, this spacecraft can only survive an estimated 34 hours on battery power. So, it looks like it has landed safely, and it is near icy troughs in the polygonal terrain up in the northern plains of Mars. I don't know if you realize how significant this is, but this will be the first core drilling of frozen water on Mars, and should they recover microbes in that water, in that ice, it will change the way we view Mars. We really don't think that there's any life on Mars at the moment, but we're about to collect evidence to the contrary, I think. My guest tonight is John Anthony West. His website is jawsphinx@aol.com. He is the author of Serpent in the Sky, The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, And if you've seen the television network broadcast, The Mystery of the Sphinx, this was narrated by a very famous actor, Charlton Heston. I don't know, some of you younger people might not know who he was, but if the phrase, "let my people go," means anything to anyone, Charlton Heston was extremely famous in a very old movie called The Bible. And a great voice. Met him once in person. He was campaigning for a presidential candidate recently, and I was able to meet him. And he is a great guy, just very, very genuine, very concerned. Recently passed away. But to get a chance, pick up those books, pick up the video, bring yourself up to date with where real Egyptology is. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Burke.
In our last hour, we were just about to touch into what might be, well, we could call it a religious firestorm for this program anyway. X Squared Radio is all about exploring the mysteries of the universe and the Earth, and we try to go as far as we can past people's imagination as possible so that we can get all the bits and pieces together. So that they can make up their own minds intelligently, what is truth and what is fabrication and what is religion and what is spirituality. We also want to make sure that our phone lines are open. So if you're calling anywhere in the United States, the toll-free number is 888-228-4494. We also have a toll-free number for Canadians, 877-489-6350. And if you don't have to worry about long-distance charges, you can reach us anywhere on planet or off planet. If you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. Now, John, we were talking about not-so-ancient Egypt, maybe 2,000 years ago, where it is commonly believed that A Jewish child was raised by Mary, a virgin at birth, a virgin mother, and Joseph, her spouse, but at least from the record, not Jesus's direct father. He was of the Immaculate Conception, the Son of God, and many other descriptions of him. And far be it from us to take away from that. But it is interesting, at least from a scholarly point of view and a scientific point of view, that the pattern, the details of Jesus' family were well known in Egypt long before they got there, allegedly, right?
That's right. Yes, sir.
So let's talk about that pattern of family. Who were the members of this very ancient family to have very, very similar characteristics to the one we read about in the New Testament?
Well, you see, that's a mythological family, as it were. I mean, nobody thinks that there's a human being named Horus and a human being named Isis and a human being named Set and a human being named Osiris, but the roles that they play get transmitted into Christianity as though they were history. So in Egypt, for example, in the Temple of Luxor, there's a little room exactly at the place that the Temple of Luxor is proportioned and built exactly to the scale of a human body. And at the place, at the chamber where that corresponds to the vocal cords, there's a scene on the wall in which the Queen Mother, mother of Amenhotep III, is being embraced, locking hands with the god Amon, and Amon is telling her, and this is 1350 BC, that she will soon give birth to a divine child. This is the Annunciation. This is a central tenet of Christianity, except no one thinks that it's people in the Egyptian myth. It is a mythological expression of the inherent divinity of humanity, of the divine man, symbolized, or let's say the prototype, is the Pharaoh. But he's the prototype. It doesn't mean that he's the only one that is privileged in this way. He's the prototype. We all are. if we take advantage of it and do the necessary kind of inner work, and this gets transmitted into and becomes actually Christianity, except there it's historicized. And as I said earlier, I'm not committed to any particular point of view on this. Other than that, from the scholarly point of view, there is no question that virtually everything doctrinal that you associate with Christianity has its antecedents, but exact, in Egypt. And as I said earlier, there's a vast literature on this. Perhaps the most important book written around, I think it was 1907, by an extraordinary scholar and poet named senior moment, it's escaped me, Gerald Massey, called Ancient Egypt, Light of the World, where he explores these relationships. And recently, a rather interesting book, not as solid, but drawn upon a lot upon Massey's work, is a book called The Pagan Christ by an Anglican priest named Tom Harper, H-A-R-P-U-R, which summarizes, he's got his Egyptology a bit crooked, but it's a much, let's say it's a much more concise and readable book than Massey's. But there's a ton of stuff out there, and you never hear about this. You certainly don't hear it from the Christian church, and you don't hear much about it from the archaeological, Egyptological community either. But the relationships, the correspondences are exact, and they are manifold. They're all there. I mean, there's nothing in Christian doctrine, in the Gospels, for example, that you can't find in Egypt. I mean, it's there.
Well,
and
there are
the scene that we see on the wall in 1350 B.C. is just a later expression of a doctrine that was current in Egypt from the very beginning.
There are a couple of places in particular. One, I guess when the Aswan Dam was built, it flooded a lot of some of the ancient sites in northern Egypt, and they relocated one to an island, which you have to take a boat to get to, I understand. And it has...
You always did. That's Philae you're talking about, probably, right?
Right, right. And it has in it the story of how Isis and Osiris and Horus, came of age, basically.
Right.
And then the other is, as we've already been discussing, Seti's temple.
Yes.
And one of the remarkable writers of this area is, I can't remember, I'm trying to remember his name now, Hani, I just call him Hani.
Hani El-Zaini.
Yeah, Hani El-Zaini, right. And he worked with a woman whose name was Om Seti.
Yeah.
She became known as Om Seti. She was actually a British woman, later in life moved from England to Egypt in a time when neither women nor Englishmen were welcome very much in Egypt. But she had Hani convinced, and Hani, mind you, is an engineer, ran a sugar a factory there in Nag Hammadi. So he's an engineer, and he's an educated man, very well spoken. His wife is a pharmacist, both very gracious people. Had Hani convinced that she was the reincarnated girl whose name was Om Seti. And she knew where things were buried in the ground, around the grounds of Seti's temple. And she made some comments about, and this is what really struck me, because I actually held her handwritten book in my hands. I looked at her hieroglyphs as she copied them down in the book and translated them. The interesting thing about the hieroglyphs is that they're exact, that it didn't matter who wrote them. The proportions were exactly correct, no matter where you see them.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that there's something about the perfect replication of these shapes, these icons, this particular language, that awakens things in people, whether they know the language or not. Some kind of iconic meaning that goes behind this language, which is unique in the world, right?
Yes.
So the thing about Seti's temple is that the work in there is just magnificent. And it's all carved out of solid stone. No mistakes. and all the proportions are correct. Why do you think it was so important that the imagery of not just the hieroglyphs, but the imagery of Isis and Osiris and the devices that seemed to be transportation devices that got them to the underworld or to the afterlife? Why do you think this was so important to them?
Well, getting it right is really analogous to why a musician plays the notes right, because if you don't play it right, you don't get the music. So it's the same kind of precision that's involved, but they're not talking about, I don't think that they're talking about, Abydos, I don't know what you're referring to with the so-called helicopters and tanks, which is not the case, actually. It's not that at all.
Those are way up in the ceiling. I'm talking what William Henry calls the Osiris device. Seems to be some kind of, I don't really know, some kind of resonation device.
Yes. You have to get the music right. So it's we have this too, but it's in a secular place. I mean, if you don't swing the bat right, you don't hit the ball. We have this all over the place, but we just don't think of it as a transformational exercise. But in Egypt, as I said earlier, it's a one-issue civilization. Everything is dedicated to the transformation and the divinization of the soul. And in order for that to happen, you have to do it right. And later on, in Ptolemaic times, they lost it, and you can't miss it when you look at the art and the artwork. In Seti's time, they had it right. By the way, I knew Seti reasonably well in the early 80s, and Hani El-Zeini I know quite well. I haven't seen him in a few years. He's around. Did you meet him when you were there?
Yeah, he lives in Cairo. And
he's now, he must be late 80s or so, right?
Yeah, late 80s. Still
and he lives far enough away from where I am in Egypt at the Mina house, so that I haven't been in touch with him lately. But do you know that most recent book, a very interesting lady called Catherine Dees, D-E-E-S, called,
right.
She worked with Hani on this new book, I think called The World of Om Seti, where she goes into the private diaries of Om Seti, where she's, you know, we're talking about Seti is her ex-lover. Om Seti, by the way, is not an ancient Egyptian name. It means mother of Seti.
Right.
That's Arabic, because she had her son. He called her one son Seti. So that's where Om Seti comes from. It's not the name of her early reincarnation. I don't know if she actually knew that, but it wouldn't have been Om Seti.
But it was interesting, the knowledge that she knew,
and she even
talks about having a fever one time and then slipping and falling and going into
her
chamber, and she brought out a ceremonial cloth that was later carbon dated to be from that age of the sixth dynasty.
I didn't know that actually.
And she,
I knew the story. I didn't know about the cloth.
She evidently returned it.
I
never told anyone where that crypt was, but I guess lots and lots of people have looked for it.
A lot of people have looked for it, and so far no one's found it. But again, I don't know if they've gone looking for it with seismographs or not.
Hani's writing another book with Melissa Gilbert. Melissa Gilbert's also an engineer, and she's has some kind of amazing connection with this area, because her and Hani just hit it off right away, and I know that they're working on a book, and I can't wait to see that work, because it's going to be about the Assyrian.
I know her, Melissa Gilbert. Is she red-haired?
Red-haired, exactly.
What?
Yes, she has red hair.
Yeah. I met her ages ago. It rings a bell. Long ago, I forget when it was. And she was moving. I think she was moving to Abydos, right?
Oh, my gosh.
I think.
No, I haven't spoken to her in a long time, but
me either.
She is.
But I thought she was going there. I didn't know she was working with Hani. But the Catherine Dees book, have you read that?
I have, yeah.
I thought that was very interesting. I'm, I'd say, of two minds of the love story, but I'm not in any position to dispute it, but I'm also not obliged to accept it.
I'm not in a position to dispute it either, but it is difficult to dispute the fact that she could go out to places where she said she lived in a village, and there's nothing but sand there.
Yeah.
And they excavated, and sure enough, there's a village there.
Yeah, they did. And they found she points it to the, I mean, the Egyptologists don't know what to make of her because they think she's nuts. But a couple of times she said, well, dig here. And they dug and she said, Dick, are you going to find this and such there? And they found it. This is true. No doubt about it. It's actually one of the more interesting and convincing of the, I mean, there's lots of reincarnational literature, but her story is one of the most intriguing.
Well, I guess the point that I was make is now we have layers upon layers of evidence that the soul, the human being, the thing that makes John, the thing that makes a bird, it seems to exist beyond life, even before the Earth right now. And the kind of improvement that happens to the intelligent, sentient, peace-loving being, lifetime after lifetime, until they reach a point, a finishing point, where mortality is no longer necessary. And then it's time to move on to a higher realm of existence, godhood, if you want to put it that way. And it seemed like the pharaohs and the Christ-like motifs were on last step. And they were trying to, by example, or by teaching, or by impression, teach other people that they had that ability as well. That
yeah.
They could make the step.
Well, that's right. I mean, the pharaoh was the living Horus on Earth. Horus is the divine child who avenges the murder of his father, Osiris, by his wicked uncle Set, which becomes Hamlet, which becomes the Lion King in its most modern incarnation. And that was the role of the pharaoh. And as I said earlier, he was the prototype. In other words, he was the realized or divinized human being, but it doesn't mean he was the only one. It just means that he set the example, and I reckon that they probably, at least an awful lot of them, got to the stage that they were supposed to get to in order to keep such a thing going for 3,500 years. I mean, tyrannies don't last very long, as we've seen.
No, there has to be a way to give people hope.
That was the role of the pharaoh. He was the living Horus, and the Horus, as I was talking about earlier, Horus is the Christ. And actually,
and
Jesus, the biblical character, Jesus Christ, embodies both the, I mean, Jesus is the mortal man with divinity imminent within him, effectively Osiris, and the Christ, the Horus, the divine child who achieves immortality, is the Son. So actually, Christianity wove those two characters together, but the story is absolutely Egyptian.
Well, wasn't it Isis that put him back together?
Yes. Isis, and Isis is the goddess who's, I mean, in one sense, she's the mother of Jesus, but it's an immaculate conception. And again, the esoteric doctrine underlying it is that we as human beings are fractured. We're cut into pieces like Osiris, and it's through one of her other roles of Isis is she's the mistress of magic. Magic is actually not hocus pocus, but magic in the Egyptian sense is the science of transformation. So this is an inner process, and through that inner process, the fractured personality or the fractured essence gets put back together. And once it's put back together, then you're capable, the Osiris part of you is capable of immaculately conceiving the divine child. And this is, again, I said earlier, Egypt is a one-issue civilization. It's entirely devoted to the quest for immortality. And that quest for immortality is specifically on the human level, not on the cosmological level, but on the human level, built into that very complex Isis, Osiris, Horus myth, which becomes the Jesus story. It really, it all follows, and it's not that difficult to understand, but you can't understand it just with your head. You have to understand it, well, really with your gut.
Well,
the Egyptians did that.
The interesting thing about this is that all of this, whether you're visiting there as a tourist or whether you're hearing it from some spiritual leader, is all very inspirational, and it has a ring of truth to it. As you say, you're something in your gut tells you that it's true. It brings something to your remembrance. It's not new to you.
That's right.
However, when you look at least modern history, and I'm going to call modern history since, you know, man first charged across the frozen tundra at one another with battle axes in hand, it seems religion has been at the core of every major war that has been recorded. So if we have this great inspirational 3,500-year history to go by of peace, and of expansion, and of huge technology, and great wealth, and abundance for a people to go by, why are we fighting each other, even from church to church in our local hometowns? One congregation or another is surely going to hell because they don't belong to the other. Why are we doing that?
Well, why? Partly because we've got the Church of Progress has it all wrong. We are degenerate, and they were much less so. Yeah, and when you talk about religion, are you talking about the institution, which is one thing, or the doctrine, which is quite another? In fact, there's no religion that says you're supposed to beat up on everyone else and torture them to death and kill each other. The doctrines don't say that, but the churches and the synagogues and the mosques and the whatever, the power structure that the doctrine degenerates into, they do this. Yes, this is quite true, and they've been doing it for quite a while now.
Oh, they have.
Not necessarily always. Egypt less so. Much less so. They did have their wars. This is true, but they weren't religious wars. They weren't
murdering people
because they worshipped Baal or, you know, or Mithras.
They were wars of economy. But, the wars that we have fought since whenever have been based or at least backed by one god or another. And even if you look at the, I don't know, 1,000-plus quote-unquote Christian religions who claim to have Jesus Christ at the core of their belief system.
Well,
if they go back, to the man Jesus himself, he didn't establish any church. In fact, he fought the church on a regular basis.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Peter is the rock upon which the church is founded. So he was if he was an actual human being, he was out to do that. But hey, listen. Now there's a Church of Progress, and its devotees, Stalin and Mao, are doing a pretty good job without any religion.
But I think Jesus is more or less saying, I'm not the church, but I am the way.
Well, that's right, exactly.
Do it.
That's right. And as soon as there's an institution grown up around a doctrine, and power becomes the preeminent, let's say, the preeminent quality or the preeminent focus of that religion, the doctrine disappears and it becomes what we've seen in the last couple of thousand years. Worse in the West than in the East, but not exactly a pretty picture there. But, I mean, no religion has ever been as bloodthirsty as Christianity, which is the one that's based more than any of the others upon the whole concept of charity and loving your neighbor and, you know, loving your enemy and all that sort of thing. You know, go find a Christian who loves his enemy.
I have to agree with you there.
But the doctrine doesn't say this.
That's true.
And actually, it's now very fashionable in Darwinian and rationalist circles to to really come down murderously on religion. And it's not that they're wrong, it's just that that's only one side of the picture, because if you go into Christianity, is a very strange, polarized religion, because even as the horrible crusades and the god-awful Inquisition was going on, they were building these fabulous churches. And when you walk into those churches, you know you're not in Walmart. I mean, these are very special places, and particularly the early ones, Romanesque and then the Gothic cathedrals. You walk in there and you're in touch with divinity. Somebody knew something, even as the other idiots were off murdering each other. So it has that upside.
They're small and somewhat ignominious, you know, built on ley lines or intersections of power. I mean, if you go to Roslyn Chapel in Scotland, you know, it's kind of a small country church, but there's no doubt when you walk into it and you look at the carvings in the walls, they knew something.
That's right. But Chartres is not a small church, and you walk in there, if you're lucky enough to get in there at dawn when before all the thousands of tourists hit, you're in the presence of something very, very special. And you go to some of the earlier churches, Romanesque, 10th, 8th, 9th century. I was just in Milan visiting a couple of these places, and they're spectacular. So, yes, you can say all of the horrible things you want to about religion, and all of those things are true, but, you know, without religion, there'd be no Monteverdi and no Bach and no Beethoven and none of that wonderful music. You know, hip-hop doesn't touch upon those things. It has its own validity, but something right is going on even as all of that stuff is going wrong. And, you know, you've got to keep both sides in view.
John, how does all this tie together? You know, the voyages of the pyramid builders, the builders of Stonehenge and the Machu Picchu and the Gate of the Sun. How does all this tie together? What are these ancient civilizations trying to leave behind through cataclysm after cataclysm for us, for this day, for the end of the procession? What are they trying to tell us?
Well, I'm not so sure that they're built for that reason. I don't dismiss it, but I think they're building those things. I think they're building those things for their own use. In other words, that the doctrine of the immortality of the soul is understood by all of the people who are doing that. And in the doing is the transformation. In other words, you know, if you're playing in if you're playing in a symphony orchestra, the idea is to play whoever's music perfectly, and in the perfection, in the act of perfection, is the process of transformation. And this applies to everything that's done well. Even playing a baseball game, it's not easy to be a professional baseball player. In the doing of it, that's the reward. If you're doing it for the future or for immortality, if you're doing it for the future or you're doing it for your own, let's say, for your own ego, you got it all wrong. You're doing it for the inner reward, and it's not necessary. I don't dismiss that when they're building the pyramids, they're putting all of this information in there. But I don't necessarily accept that they may know about the cycles of time. Another might well know that really bad times are coming up. But whether or not they're encoding it in order that somebody, when they're ready, finds out about it from them, maybe. I don't know.
The doing of it
is the important thing.
I understand. The reason I bring it up is, for instance, the Mayan calendar
in
21st, 2012. So,
right.
You know, there is some, at least, you know, changing of the guard, if not
definitely
about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is clear, if I might just continue with your motif, that they did leave the instruments behind, but they took the music with them.
Yeah, and actually the Mayan, that 2012 is really interesting, because if I didn't know anything about the Mayan calendar, I didn't know anything about any of those things, and just reading the papers, I don't bother to read the papers, getting the news off the internet, my guess would be that's about the amount of time we have left before something really serious happens. Not necessarily entirely catastrophic, but something major, something that's going to, some event or a series of events or who knows what, but that, I mean, there is no such thing as business as usual, but where business becomes even more unusual than usual.
Well, are we talking about an event similar to that might have ended the Sphinx builders or caused them to move on, or are we talking
Who knows? Actually, funny, because that's the plan of the new book that I'm putting together a proposal for. I've done an essay. I was author of the month on Graham Hancock's website a couple of months ago, and the essay was called "Consider the Kali Yuga." And I think you have two processes going on simultaneously, but they're part of the same process. And as an analogy, it's like the seasons of the year. And let's say the Dark Age, what in Hindu terminology is the Kali Yuga. And one of the problems we face, and it's a very interesting and maybe important problem, is where we are in that cycle. And where we are is not a very pretty place. But because you see all of these looming catastrophes hitting. At the same time, we have this extraordinary technology and creativity at our fingertips, most of it deployed toward weapons of mass destruction and bobblehead dolls in Disneyland. Nevertheless, the energy, the creative energy, is there. And if the ideas change, everything changes. In other words, the stupidest television show or the most insulting ad campaign that you can imagine is nevertheless the result of an enormous amount of directed creative energy and intelligence. The ad might be stupid, but a lot of smart people produce this ad. If suddenly all of that, not necessarily even suddenly, but if over a period of time, relatively quickly, that creative energy were directed towards something genuinely constructive and, again, directed
well,
towards...
in your opinion, do you think perhaps the rise of leadership with wisdom, leadership with some kind of ancient perspective that could come from wherever, I don't care what nation it comes from, could stand up and say, listen, yes, it's true that weapons technology has probably driven the science and financed the science to get us to this point, but it's time to step away from the precipice of destruction and take advantage of this transcendence which we have at the threshold and the knowledge to do it.
Well, maybe. But I mean, it would take a Buddha-like or a Christ-like figure that to wield that kind of inner authority. And to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of such a person. That certainly isn't me. But it isn't even absolutely necessary. In other words, horror. I mean, let's face it: the media now, the mainstream media, is entirely made up of whores. Working for the most unscrupulous people on earth. And nobody with any sense reads the stupid papers and actually listens to Fox News and believes what they get. But on the other hand, we have this extraordinary web technology in which, okay, 90% of that is pornography, but the other 10% can be pretty interesting. And so the ability now of getting certain messages out there away from, let's say, from the academic ivory towers and away from the compromised media empires is amazing, unless they figure out a way to shut down the web.
There's no question that there's a Gutenberg-like usefulness to the internet, that we can now disseminate information
to all
peoples, even in Nepal. You can go to an cafe and you can Google things and you can get information.
That's right. Yeah, well,
Maybe where all the other civilizations failed, they might have had high technology in this spot or that spot, but they couldn't disseminate it quick enough. They couldn't spread it worldwide quickly enough to get everybody on their feet and moving in the right direction at one time. Now we can. So how do we take what you've discovered and written about and get it out to enough people to where, you know, the next time they throw a war, people just say, nah, we're not going to do that. We know what this is all about.
I don't know. If I knew, I'd be doing it. That's what we're doing now in this conversation. Whoever's listening, we're talking about civilization when it was really civilization and not progress and not with a bunch of lunatics in charge. And we're putting forward ideas. Well, the ideas are very interesting. But then the main thing is what everyone forgets. Here we're talking about religion before. Practically nobody, especially the people who are in charge of the religion, realize that religion is something you do. It almost doesn't matter what the hell you believe. I mean, a lot of the atheists I know are much better Christians than the people who are telling everybody else what they should do with their bodies and what you should smoke or not smoke. But the point of it is that you have to do it. That's the problem. So first you have to get the message, and if you're sitting there watching Fox News, you're not going to get the message. Once you get the message, then you have to recognize that it applies to you and to everyone else, and then you have to do it. It's like if you want to be a base, I keep using these analogies, but they're really true. We don't think of them as religious or transformational exercises, but doing anything well takes effort. You can't think about being a baseball player or a musician. You have to do it. So if suddenly you get you're bitten by the idea that there is really a certain kind of, I almost hate to use the word because it's so compromised, but there's that self-development is essential. You can't think about it. You actually have to do it. And that's what, horrible as they become, the institutions, that's what, in theory, religions are about. Whereas opposed to that, I mean, the religion that now rules the Western world, particularly, is the Church of Progress, and that denies that there is such a thing as self-development. I mean, we're an accident, and Darwinian evolution is how it all happened, and we're thinking apes. And this is actually a religion of total despair and nihilism, but that is, in fact, what controls our educational system. So you have to say that everything we've learned in school is a bunch of garbage, and let's start from scratch. But then, easy enough to say, then you have to do it. Now, that's where we stand, but we do have this extraordinary technology at our fingertips.
And it seems as though religious politics is starting to take hold, too, where, you know, the notion that the Earth could get along much better without us, and that in some case or some reason or another, or some way or another, we need to be banned from going into the wilderness ever again, and we need to be banned from, you know, putting anything into the air, anything into the water. And I was noticed an article in the paper, I don't know, about a month ago, some group for the climate protection is going to raise and spend $100 million a year for the next 3 years for global warming awareness.
Yeah.
And, you know, my day job, I happen to be an engineer and building biodiesel plants, which to me it gets us off foreign oil, quits burning petroleum, which is ridiculous, and start growing fuel out of non-food sources and making our own fuel that's clean burning and better for the engines and blah blah blah. So I said to myself, well, I'll write them. I'll say, okay, I'll write them and ask for a $300,000 grant to build a lab so we can figure out better uses for glycerin. They wrote back and said, oh, no. We're only about awareness. We only want to support political candidates and do awareness. And I said, yes, okay, now I see the nature of the beast. So this new religion of progression is one that separates man from the earth and makes man some sort of infection to the planet that it must be expunged of. And it pulls away from all of these ancient civilizations, let's not call them religions, the Mayans, the Incans, the Toltecs, the Zapotecs.
Yeah, they're religions. That's
the ancient Egyptians. And yes, we called it religion, but they called it kind of a, you know, a way of coexisting with the galaxy. And the galaxy was their home, and they could travel to it and from it.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, they could. I think so. I'm also, yeah. But, you know, it's... I mean, given the problems that are facing it, I mean, most of these efforts, well-meaning as they may be, are in a way futile. When you're saying that, I can understand them saying the awareness, but the awareness sort of starts at home. I mean, it's really fairly simple. In one sense,
you become aware.
I mean, stop buying stuff. Look at, I mean, the poorest people in America have 20 times as much stuff that they actually need, and most of it is rubbish.
Oh,
no doubt.
People
stop buying stuff. Really, if there were a big move to cut back, they're going to have to do it anyway. A friend of mine in this book that I helped him write called it Involuntary Voluntary Simplicity. If people just stopped, if people were obliged to stop doing what they do, and in fact, if they could do that with some kind of a sense of self-awareness and an understanding that we, as human beings, have a legitimate destiny on this earth and that the ancients understood it, things could change quickly, because ideas are very powerful. When ideas change, everything changes. So, but the ideas are central. And all of these, a lot of these ecological measures and the global warming and all of this stuff are band-aids for the most part. They don't address the central problem, which is that due to the Church of Progress, most people do not even believe that we have a destiny, that we have a purpose in this. You know, in fact, we're taught that we do not serve a purpose. We are freaks of accidental glitches in an accidental universe. And really, the most, let's say, in my opinion, the worse than communism and fascism is Darwinian evolution, which teaches meaninglessness as a philosophy. Materialism, rationalism, is a nihilistic philosophy. And as long as people behave that way, nothing can happen but destruction.
Well, it's clear that these great civilizations, at least officially, understood the purpose of life and understood the value of life and the value of eternal progression. And nothing could be further from our modern-day society, to be sure, to think that we could shift our concentration on weaponry and war to something, if we could apply our technology and our ability to fund technology to mastering the energy of this planet, perhaps the solar system, perhaps the galaxy, and reach the zenith that these other civilizations only tried to reach, and realize that you know, there is an importance in the history that they left behind for us. We don't really know where they went, and as we had said before, they've left the instruments behind. Why can't we just figure out what the music is and then face it, and then, like you say, do it?
Well, recreate the music. Yeah, well, that's the purpose of the exercise, as far as I'm concerned. That's what's important about those past things, and you see, what you just said, I lost the thread a little bit, but no, they actually did it. But they were, let's say, on a descending cycle. So this is what makes it. This is what complicates an already complicated issue. Egypt is at its height, at its beginning, and whatever was going on before was at even a higher level. But the instruments are there, and we now know. Well, we know enough about the doctrine. Actually, the trick is, as I said before, to understand how important it is and to practice it. See, this is what they did. In fact, the practice was the building of that stuff. It's like, again, analogy, baseball or music. You want to play baseball, you can't think about it. You have to do it all day long. And this is one of the problems with the whole New Age movement. Music, the same. You want to be a concert violinist, you stop watching television and you practice 14 hours a day. But people think they can sort of sit around and sniff a crystal and go to a seminar somewhere for a weekend, and they're spiritual. It's not like that.
Exactly right.
It's the hardest work. It's the hardest work of all. And there's no batting average to tell you how far you've gone, or you know, it's because there are no. You know, not back then, when there was a Egypt and India and all of these places, there was an ongoing tradition of really developed human beings who presumably were in a position to judge their students as far as, you know, and tell you if you're doing it wrong or doing it right. But now there's almost nobody. You can't go into a church and expect anything sensible from your priest.
Now, what happened to
what happened
to the soul when they were doing it right in ancient Egypt?
Oh, well, that's where all that wonderful art and architecture comes from. That's what happens, but it can't be. You can't read about it in the book. I mean, you can read about it in the book, but then you have to understand that it's something that you personally and then collectively have to do. And when enough people, you know, take the bit in their mouth and start doing it, then things change. But the ideas come first, because without the ideas, you don't know what the hell you're doing. Or it's very difficult to know what you're doing. So, in principle, somebody once described golf, and I looked it up, I couldn't find who it was who said it, that golf is a very easy game, a very simple game that's very difficult to play. Well,
right. I know one
religion
thing.
Is like that. It's very easy to talk about things like concepts like divinity and the immortality of the soul, but go try to do it. This is difficult.
But once it's
understood that A, you have to do it, and B, that it is difficult, and if you want to do it, you have to do it all the time. You can't just go for a weekend someplace.
Well, that's true.
At some point, maybe stuff starts changing. I don't know. I think there's terribly destructive forces at work that cannot be stopped. But at the same time, it's like spring when there's a, let's say in terms of the cycle, we're somewhere around February, and there's a horrible, there's a blizzard blowing. A long-time blizzard. But underneath the blizzard, the seeds are, the fertile seeds are germinating. And until the blizzard blows over, they're not going to necessarily germinate and spring to life. But the two, in other words, the living force, spiritual force, call it, is actually there and detectable. But at the same time, anybody who tries to deny that the blizzard is blowing is just not awake and living in the real world, because all of this horrible stuff is going on.
Well, I know that there are people that can walk out in the noonday. There are people that can walk out in the noonday sun, look up into the sky, and say, it is night. They just don't perceive what's going on around them. And
well, yeah.
Although the seeds are you know, dormant underneath the snow, we do have the calendar. We do hope that spring is coming.
That's right. But this is, to my mind, I mean, the kind of stuff that we're doing, myself and my colleagues, of making, this is what this program is about, is that making whoever's listening aware of the cyclical nature of the whole process, and that in the distant past, and very distant past, and then in certain cases not all that different past, people really did understand that we individually and collectively have a role to play in this cosmos, but that it's up to us, initially individually, because that's all you can work on, but if enough people are doing it, it starts to have a force. And at some point or another, stuff starts to happen, maybe.
Well, all we're really asking people to do here tonight and tomorrow morning when they go into work and log onto their computer and listen to this archive is that, you know, pick up John Anthony West's books, read and open your mind and realize that there's a lot more to it than just living from payday to payday. There's a purpose to life, and there's a value to life, and there's a value to the human soul. And great civilizations maintained peaceful, open-minded, exploratory existences for millennia without a violent war, except to defend themselves, certainly not for religion. And that all we're asking people to do is look at the evidence, open your eyes, and see that the sun is actually shining. It's not dark. there were civilizations here before our history books so vainly and egotistically start. And the sooner we realize that, the better off we'll be.
Yes. Agreed.
So, agreed. Well, let's go ahead and take a four-minute break. And,
okay.
Actually, it's 5 minutes and 32 seconds. We'll do that, and we'll make sure to remind you that the phone lines are open. We're going to reach the last 45 minutes here, and my guest tonight is John Anthony West. His website is on our website at x2-radio.com. We'll be back.
Thank you, brother.
Friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. PVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. PVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up PVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today.
Yeah. What?
If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. And they have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio. Volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the method necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio.
device expands consciousness. The device is vital to space travel.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from the eastern Washington states, right up against the Idaho border, near the Canadian border. We're glad that you're here with us. My AccuWindow forecast says it's 71 degrees, slightly overcast, and the wind, as always, is blowing. Some had hoped it might just be an illusion, but it looks like dark energy is real and here to stay, as astronomers image the mysterious entity in action. Astronomers have struggled to explain what dark energy actually is, leading some to speculate that it may not exist at all. Some have claimed that even distributions of matter within the universe could distort our measurements of the distance to supernova, fooling us into thinking they are farther away than they really are, like that right-hand rear-view mirror you have. But supervoids of empty space and superclusters of galaxies are slightly cooler or warmer, respectively, than expected in maps of the cosmic microwave background because of dark energy. So even though we can't directly detect it, it does appear that their footprint is left behind. Excuse me. Also want to let you know, Volume 3, Unlocking the Secret, 2012, the final volume of the Arc of Millions of Years series, is now for sale. You can go to Amazon and buy it, or you can buy it off the website at arcofmillionsofyears.com, or you can buy it off the front of X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. We will be appearing around the country doing some promotional things for the book. Until then, you can pick up your copy. If you already own Volume 1 and Volume 2, add this one to your set. And you might want to just reorder all the other two books as well, because the covers have been redone and now they all kind of fit together. Same motif, but just coordinated to all fit together. And by the way, all the proceeds, at least for the DVDs, the Inner Earth Expedition, all the proceeds do go toward the expedition, and we'll be bringing you an update on that next week. Not enough time to go into it tonight. My guest tonight is John Anthony West, Egyptologist extraordinaire, author of many books, lecturer, and he's with us tonight. We want you to call in this final hour anywhere in the U.S., 888-228-4494. In Canada, we also have a toll-free number, 877-489-6350. And you can reach us also by cell phone or regular long distance. Or if you don't have any long distance charges, don't worry about it. It's 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. And we'll even take calls over your voice over internet. So if you're using Skype, you can reach us at bbsradio_com. If you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBS Radio. We are a member of the BBS Radio Network, and we are also being carried by the SteelEye Media Network, courtesy of our friend Kevin Smith. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Brooke. But I must say, dark energy isn't a problem. All you have to do is look at Washington, D.C., and you've got all the dark energy you need to understand.
Oh, boy, yeah. Every time I go to Washington, I'm just amazed at the conglomeration of loosely associated bureaucracies all vying for the same treasury. And
yeah,
the elected officials are actually ineffectual and, shall I say, emasculated in Washington. Every bureaucrat knows that they were there before the elected official got there, and they will be there when they're gone. So you see how much power they have in Washington. Not much. So, but I would say be careful as you vote. Don't just pull the handle based on what promises to fill your mailbox with a check. Have a broader vision than that, at least this time around. We are talking about end times forces as we near 2012. what were the ancient civilizations, and I don't mean the Egyptians and the Mayans, I mean the ones that were there before they got there, the ones from whom the Mayans and the Egyptians inherited their technology.
We have a caller, line 3.
So just want you to pay attention to all of these signs as we go into this final hour. We do have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. This is Mark from Nashport, Ohio.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
I just had a few quick questions.
Okay.
How many tons in the pyramid are the largest stones?
Oh, 70 in the Great Pyramid, the ones above the King's Chamber, granite blocks.
How did they get them there?
Ah, you tell me. Nobody knows. The usual explanation from the quackademics, as I like to call them, is that ramps and lots of guys pushing and pulling got them there. I don't know. But they got them up there, and they got them up there with absolute precision. You can't barely fit a razor blade between them. And we don't know. In fact, we don't know how they built those things at all. And if you read in, you know, any Egyptological book, when they pretend that they say that they know, they don't. They're guessing. And the engineers and the people who move blocks around nowadays look at these things and are absolutely astounded. And it's one of, let's say, a whole pantheon of mysteries that surrounds these extraordinary structures. When you see it for yourself, talking about it or even reading about it, looks impressive, but when you actually see these things, you just marvel and say, I don't know. Nobody knows.
Could we today, with our technology, do something similar?
You know, we can fly to the Mars and things like that. If it were important to us to do so, we might be able to figure out a way to do it, but it would be using the most advanced equipment that we have. And probably even that equipment would have to be modified because you've got to get it up there. And if we're talking about the stones inside the pyramid in the King's Chamber, well, they're up a couple of hundred feet, actually, off the ground. So you've got to get them up there and then get the stones up to the point where you can put them into place. But if it were important to us, maybe we could, but we can be pretty sure that whoever put them up there didn't do it that way. They had some other way, and that's the big mystery. We don't know.
Well, one thing's for sure, when you're talking about the energy that it takes to get that stone that high, it doesn't exist in human flesh.
Yeah, it looks that way, but actually when we're on site, it's hard to talk about these things on the radio. When I'm on my trips, and we're actually in front of the Sphinx Temple or up in the Great Pyramid, And then we talk about it, and you know, you can break it down into, let's say, into certain possibilities. One is that, do we have a bit of time here? One is that there are four possibilities which are not necessarily, at least I can think of, four possibilities that are not necessarily mutually exclusive. The first is, and this is the only one allowed by the academics, that it's a primitive technology used very skillfully. The engineers, today's engineers and quarrymen say, well, no, it couldn't be done that way. But they can't do it either. And I love to use analogies. If you've been listening in, you know that. And if you put a violin in my hand, I will prove to you that music cannot be wrung out of this device. But you give it to a violinist who's got 30 years of practice, and he gets the music out. So it's not impossible that they had some simple method that we just plain don't know and we can't reproduce. The second possibility is that they had a hard technology. Again, an analogy. Suppose somebody finds a computer 10,000 years from now, and either they don't have electricity or their electricity comes from a different source, and they look at this thing, it doesn't have any moving parts, and they say, oh, it's a religious object. But they don't know that, you know, you press a button in the right way, and out comes the whole Library of Congress stored on a chip. So it may be that certain things that we're looking at in these ancient civilizations is actually technology. Maybe. I must say this is not a favorite possibility of mine. The third is that people with certain kinds of training can do what looks physically impossible. And there are lots of instances of that. You know, documented cases where a child gets run over by a car and the mother comes along and picks up the car and moves it off the child. And she can't do that a minute before that happens, and she can't do it a minute after that happens. But under certain conditions, martial arts masters can do unbelievable things. It's possible that with intense kind of training and knowing what you're doing, the impossible to us is not only possible but easy for them.
Sure,
and there's a sort of a soft technology, moving things with sound. Or you can move things with sound. I mean, now it takes a big machine to lift a little pea with pea-sized stone with sound. But it could be that some combination of those factors enabled them to do that. I mean, there are lots of theories out there that they had ways of reversing gravity, or they had ways of negating gravity and lifting these things up. I mean, there are parlor tricks where seemingly impossible things can be done. So maybe, and or some combination thereof. We don't know. I mean, I'm not exactly talking through my hat. I'm just trying to be systematic about a mystery. And the fourth, which is not my favorite one, but I not discount it, is that aliens done it. But then you're confronted with the problem of how did the aliens get so smart. But we don't know. Answer to your question is I don't know.
Okay.
Next question.
Dr. Agnew, I had one quick question for you, or just kind of a statement. I don't know, did you catch Ed Dames on Coast to Coast here recently?
No, I didn't.
No, I haven't caught him on there, but I have spoken to Brent Miller, and Ed has agreed to come on our expedition next year.
Well, anyway, you might find this interesting. One of his team has seen and looked into the future and has seen that algae is the way that we will produce most of our oil in the future.
Well, that doesn't take remote viewing. That just takes our company. We've been doing algae for 7 years, and a week ago we just released a press release. We're getting ready to open a 5,000-acre facility in Utah, and we've invited 13 nations to join us, and they'll be taking that technology back to their countries so that we can turn algae into diesel fuel and quit drilling it out of the earth.
Yeah, but we're still pumping it into the air.
So I'm glad to see that Ed agrees with me.
Yeah?
He does agree with you, and thanks for taking my call.
Oh, no problem, Mark. Call back anytime.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right, so John, let's talk about these last couple that you had here. We're talking about being able to manipulate gravity, and I was actually talking to a guide one time. And
talking to who?
A guide, you know, an Egyptian guide. And I said, look, I'd like to know how they move, for instance, a 20-ton block. Forget about the 70-ton ones. He said, well, slaves did it. I said, okay, well, let's talk about that for a second. How much weight can a slave pick up? He said, oh, about 100 kilos. I said, okay, well, that makes sense. Pretty strong slave. But okay. Now, let's line up slaves. Imagine that we're lining them up around this block. Side by side, how many do you think we can get around this block to try to pick it up? He said, oh, I don't know, it's 150. I said, okay, that's a good guess. That's, you know, maybe they're standing sideways, but they can get their hands underneath the block. Now, there's a problem with that. He said, what? I said, you're about 5,000 slaves short of being able to pick up this block. And he got a blank look on his face.
Yeah.
I said, no, you don't understand. This block weighs 20 tons, you see. It takes a lot of upward force, and besides, I don't see any drawings of people slipping their hands underneath the block to pick it up and move it up whatever ramp or a ladder or some kind of elevation device to set it in place. But I do see a lot of people with their hands at a 45-degree angle, kind of like they're using their palms to radiate their energy into a block or into a sphere of some kind. Now, that would lend itself to the idea that some kind of ability, some kind of human concentration of power in a group or in a resonation way was used to lift and place blocks into place. So at least that's what I see. And all of Egypt, there is not a single drawing of how those things were built.
No, no, but that's basically my sense of how they did it, some form of concentrated human energy. But there are drawings of lots of men hauling a huge, colossal figure that has to weigh, you know, 75, 100 tons, maybe more, no, more than that even, on sledges with pouring something over the water, presumably over slick mud, and moving the blocks along. And did you get, when you were in Egypt, to the unfinished obelisk in Aswan, the 1,200-ton obelisk that didn't make it out of the ground?
I remember seeing that lay there. Yeah, it's just
yeah. Well, but that
granite.
Yeah, that's right. But actually, the way that's got out of the quarry, I was there with one of my geologist friends, who'd done extensive work in the in ancient quarries in India that are still being worked, where they're using pounding stones to get these things out of the rock, and then. Of course, then the big problem is they've got to get it out of the bedrock and into boats and move it down the river, because it's going to Luxor, and then they have to get it off the boat, and then they have to move it up. In Edfu, there's a representation of the pharaoh with ropes around the edge of the obelisk and lifting it into place. Well, obviously the pharaoh, unless he's Arnold Schwarzenegger, isn't going to do this single-handed.
Yeah.
But
that's exactly right.
But if it's hundreds of men, and they know what they're doing exactly, and, you know, the people are much more, let's say, trainable than oxen or donkeys or something like that, and they've got this thing up with guy ropes on four different directions, and somebody who knows what he's doing is figuring out a way to get this thing up and perfectly sighted on its base, on its plinth. Maybe. Normally, in Egypt, what you see is what you get. So if you see the pharaoh lifting, you know, with ropes around the obelisk, and mind you, these things, the 1,200-ton block didn't get out of the bedrock because it cracked, probably because of the pounding stones all going in resonance and suddenly the whole thing broke. But what you see is what you get. So if you see guys with a big statue on a sledge pulling it, that's probably how they pulled it. This doesn't answer how they got the things up into the pyramid, mind you, but if you see the pharaoh, who's the prototype man, as it were, it's something he's doing it single-handed, with the obelisk being raised into position with ropes, the chances are that they're not inventing that. That's how it's being done, except that there are hundreds and hundreds of men doing this. So
maybe under
you can't discount that stuff.
Then. By his word, by his command, these things are happening. But, you know, there's one thing irrefutable about engineering, and that is the failure mode. One of the things that had to have happened at some time or another is that one of those stones got off-center in the boat, and it fell and went in the water. And the interesting thing is you can travel the entire length of the Nile, and you won't find a single granite block in the mud on the bottom of
no,
the
No, actually, funnily enough, they're just now, there's a project on reckoning that there's stuff in the mud, and they're looking for them. Just now, just in the last few months.
Bet
they're doing
climb.
That. Sure, you bet there have to be lots of things in the mud. But, you know, over time, the Nile used to flood every year, and lots of mud went down there, but now with all of these imaging techniques and things like that, they'll probably be finding things. There's a project on to do that.
It'll
sure,
be
you
interesting. If they find what? Blocks on the bottom of the Nile, that's gonna lend a lot to this engineering idea. But if they don't find any blocks on the bottom of the Nile, that's gonna lend something to some other technology completely, because it doesn't make sense that you could move thousands, millions of blocks down the Nile and not lose one.
I agree, but my bet is that they'll find lots of them.
One of my IMers just finished looking at the picture of you on your website at jawest.net, and she says that you look like Sean Connery.
Really?
Who wants to know if you're
I'm flattered, but I don't think I do.
Well, I'm sure she's listening, so she knows you're flattered.
Okay.
Now let's talk about, we don't have a whole lot of time, we got about 20, 25 minutes here.
Okay.
Let's talk about the fourth possibility. I know it's not one of your favorites, but it is for our listeners.
Yeah.
And we affectionately call them aliens, but maybe they're not. Maybe they're just, you know, visitors from time to time. Or maybe they are residents of this planet. They just don't make themselves very public because we're not, you know, ready to accept them. Or maybe they don't want to be involved with what we're doing until it gets becomes too late. What about off-world, shall we call it, off-world technology being used for this architecture?
I don't, Brooks, as I said before, I don't discount it. It's just that, as you see, I mean, over the course of these couple of hours, how many times have I said, I don't know? Because I don't know. So,
well,
but with a lot of the other questions, at least they are, in principle, maybe, answerable. Whereas with the aliens, unless they show up and show us the technology, it's in principle unanswerable. So whereas I don't dismiss it, having elected to play in this scholarly arena, Coliseum, more like it, I'm concerned mostly with what is at least potentially answerable. And with the alien hypothesis, unless they show us, it's unanswerable. So as I said, I don't discount it. It's just that you can't work with it. It's sort of like channeled information. I don't discount channeled information, but when you can find what they say they've channeled, then I say, well, yeah, that's really interesting. But until then, you got to leave it alone until somebody goes looking for it and finds it.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, but, you know, you have to look. For instance, if you go into Egypt and you look at the hieroglyphs on the walls and you look at this very clear and complex language and you look at the images, and it almost to a person, whether they're Japanese or whether they're Eskimo or whether they're, you know, white Western Europeans, there seems to be a kind of code that comes out of the hieroglyph itself. Even if they can't read it, they get some kind of almost primordial imagery from it that seems to stimulate something in them.
Yes,
and when you
true.
Realize that there's no precursor to this language, there's no primitive Egyptian, there's no primitive Sumerian, it is what it is. It's a wholesale language just introduced to the world. It wasn't developed by any one leader and taught to everyone. Everyone just knew it. So,
well, we don't know that. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
But there's no evidence that there was a primer to it.
Actually, Brooks, there are a couple of very interesting books written by a friend of mine recently who might make a very good person to have on your program. His name is Laird Scranton. And he has done some really, I call him Champollion 2.0, some really interesting work on the foundation of the hieroglyphs, why certain symbols were chosen for what they represent. And there are two books, which the titles are misleading because the publisher forced them to change the titles. This is one of the pain in the neck things about dealing with publishers. The first book was called Hidden Meanings, and the second book was called Deeper Meanings, and it's now changed because it demonstrates the relationship between the Dogon, the tribe in West Africa, who have a living cosmology and tradition that they produce or reproduce symbolically on their sort of sacred structure called the granary. And now it's called, the first book is called The Science of the Dogon, and now then the second book is called The Symbols of the Dogon. And all of a sudden, I'm quite certain that he's correct, and all of a sudden you see why the hieroglyphs look the way that they do, and you're right on the money, actually. I mean, in other words, what you're saying about them, because it is, in its own way, a kind of universal symbolic language, and I think he's really decoded. He's really found out what the basis of those hieroglyphs are. So I suggest you get in touch with him and get hold of the books and see for yourself, because I think he'd be an interesting guy on your show.
I will do that. And what I know about the Dogon Indians is that they have cosmological knowledge that could not have if they were a primitive people originating here. For instance,
No.
Earth is not the third planet, it's the sixth planet, because they number the planets from Pluto in to the Sun.
No, but this is applying our way of learning to everybody's way of learning. And actually, another good book is Graham Hancock's most recent book called Supernatural. I believe that in states of higher consciousness, human beings can have direct knowledge of that, of all of these sciences, of cosmology, of astronomy, and all the rest of it. They don't need telescopes, they didn't need spaceships, they didn't need any of those things. They could do it just by being at a higher level of consciousness than we are. And we can do it sometimes on acid and drugs and things of that nature, but you know, if we're not trained, we can't use it. But I don't necessarily accept that this has to come from outer space. And if it does come from outer space, well, how did they get so smart?
Well, yeah, of course.
To me, that's not a solution.
We are, on a regular basis, launching tin cans out into space to try to learn ourselves, but we've only been doing it now for 40 years. That's it.
Well, yeah, but... Yes, I agree, but what you can say is, in fact, Laird's work's very interesting in this respect, is that this knowledge... What we're just now getting into with string theory and torsion theory and quantum mechanics and all the rest was known, and was known precisely way back then. And we're getting through technology and mathematics. I believe myself that it's unnecessary. As I said, I don't discount it, but that it's unnecessary to call in aliens because we don't understand it. We don't understand it because we, as a general rule, are not able to access those higher levels of consciousness.
So I now have more respect for your first theory that simple tools were used in ways that we just don't understand.
Well, could be. Yeah. As I said, it's a mystery to me too, but I like to be systematic about approaching the mystery.
Systematically mysterious.
What?
Systematically mysterious.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least you have a methodology for approaching the mystery. How else can you do it?
Exactly. So when we talk about this almost, deja vu kind of experience that you have as a tourist, let's say, and you visit Egypt, you visit Luxor, you visit Edfu, or one of these other sites, and you have an experience, you know, whether it's with Segment or whether it's with, you know, one of the other statues or a tomb that you visit, some kind of connection invariably happens with a person who's trying to be consciously awake. And even though they can't say what the hieroglyphs mean, they can't recite it, there's some kind of code, some kind of imagery that makes sense to a part of that person.
Yes, often. Yeah. Yes, that happens often. I mean, people, very few people come back from Egypt the way they got there. Yeah, particularly when the tour is done right and you really give people time and you really explain, you know, from the symbolist point of view that you're not looking at the work of a bunch of primitives. Yeah, people, it is, again, I hate to use the New Age word of transformational, but it really is that. Absolutely.
Well, now, you give sacred sites and sacred science tours in Egypt. When is your next one coming up?
Next one's October 28th. It's on my website. It's Magical Egypt Tours.
Okay, and this... on your website, it'll include, you know, the price for everything except your domestic travel, right?
You mean here in this country? No, the prices, actually, I don't have the... because I changed the tour around a little and the price went up a little bit, so it's that'll be up there in a few days. But basically, if you pull up the website now, I've added a date to the tour, and the price is, I think, is listed at $4,395, and it's got to go up to $4,795. But it includes the international travel and from JFK and the domestic travel within Egypt. It's a pretty competitive price.
If you're thinking about going to Egypt, I wouldn't just get on a plane and fly there on your own. I would take a tour with John Anthony West. Get yourself, take an expert with you. So not only will you avoid a lot of trouble, but in the couple of weeks that you're there, you will have an intensive, almost PhD level course in ancient Egyptology. And you'll spend a lifetime trying to digest what you pick up in a couple of weeks. Now, there's one being that doesn't appear very often in Egypt, but it doesn't appear to be human all the way. It's a being known as the Hathor. Now, what can you explain to our audience? What is a Hathor?
Well, Hathor is Hathor is one of the great goddess figures. I mean, she's the mistress of the cycles of time. The Greeks equated her in another of her aspects with their Aphrodite. In other words, she's associated with revelry, sexuality, joy, dance, procreation, as it were. She's one aspect of the cosmic feminine. A number of goddesses play that role, but from different aspects. But it's not a Hathor. It is the Hathor in many aspects. But she's the cosmic feminine. There's Dendera as a Hathor temple, and there are a number of Hathor temples, and her face, got the strange triangular face, which is actually she's the mother of the cosmic Horus. She's the cosmic version of Isis. They're linked together inextricably, and her face is actually a pregnant uterus, the shape of a pregnant uterus, which is very interesting, which was discovered by somebody on one of my trips, and then I checked it up and. An Egyptologist had come up with it himself back 70 years ago, and nobody paid any attention to him. And at a recent Egyptological conference, an academic Egyptologist had actually rediscovered it or discovered it on her own. And so it's now quite formal. But that's Hathor, yes. Which is not a Hathor. I know that's what's his name, Tom Kenyon or something. He talks about that. About his program or something or another, books about the Hathors, and there's a figure in Egyptology. They talk about the seven Hathors, but that's actually, interestingly enough, mathematical. I mean, Hathor, the numbers associated with Hathor are 7 and 11, and Egypt, the Egyptian pi, you know, the relationship between the diameter and the circumference of the circle, was expressed very closely. To a pi, 3.1415, blah, 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 as 22 sevenths, and the seven, in other words, so you might say there are 22 Hathors around the circle, and seven Hathors representing the diameter. It's the diameter that cuts the circle. The circle represents infinity. So cutting the circle represents, you might say, process or growth. It's what makes manifestation. So in other words, when I say that she's the cosmic goddess, it's she who, I mean, there are many cosmological myths expressing this, but it's, in that regard, it's the seven Hathors who set the whole process in motion. And they're always playing, or they're often playing tambourines. It's, you know, it's the joy of creation, let's say. So, very complicated, but
yeah.
You get there, you see it in front of your nose, you understand it.
That all of that geometry and trigonometry is tied in there, because
yes.
it would seem that energy, every bit of matter and every bit of energy in the universe is just energy, but it exists in two forms. One is a wave and one is a particle. And it would seem that this trigonometry is incorporated into this sound-centered being because energy is collapsing from the wave function into the particle function and thus becoming physical. So her being the divine feminine would also belie that she's giving birth to all matter in the universe.
That's right. Exactly.
So yes. the complexity becomes simplicity when you look at it that way.
And they understood that. And they didn't need the math to do it. They could show it in pictures. But yes, they understood that.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Wow. We have to book myself on that tour.
Well, put the word out and get an X Square tour together, and we'll all go.
Well, we'll leave the link on the website, and I'll put a banner on the front page of the website. And
sure.
October's not that far away. We will have to get the money in pretty fast, though, because fuel prices being what they are, you have to get these things booked.
Oh yeah.
Ahead of time. So
I mean, I've held my price for actually quite a few years, and then suddenly the last couple of years I've had to raise it every year because the prices go up and the hotel prices go up. And
so we need 19 people and me.
What?
19 people and me, 20 people, to go to Egypt in October.
Well, the October trip, I've already got a number of people going, so it can't be a dedicated trip. But November, so far, nobody. So you want to get a trip together, we'll do it in November.
I hear that later in the year is better because not only is it cooler, but the crowds are smaller.
No, the opposite. No, the crowds.
Really?
Yeah, the season basically is up to the end of October, it's pretty hot. The end of October, it's okay. But before that, it's pretty hot. And then November, end of October through March, you're okay. End of March, it's already been pretty warm, but again, it's bearable. After that, April through October, it's hot. And May, June, July, August are seriously hot. I've done trips then. If people want to go, I'll go. But you have to take it a bit easier. But anyway, end of October through March, but that's when the crowds are there. However, if you know what you're doing, and I do, I've been doing it for 25 years, it's possible for the most part to avoid the worst of the crowds, and if you do it just right, sometimes places that are absolutely jammed all day long empty out for lunch, and then you go there at lunch and bring a doggy bag, and you have it more or less to yourself. It can be done. I do it all the time.
So we're talking about perhaps a length of time in the King's Chamber, in the pyramid?
Oh, yeah, we always do that. Yeah. That's an extra. We rent it for the 2 hours and have a meditation session in the King's Chamber. Oh yeah, all of that.
Now a lot of people believe the King's Chamber was a tomb, but there was no body ever found there, right? It's not a
tomb. Not many of the pyramids were tombs. Were burials found. There's a sarcophagus there, but it's for some other reason, which I don't know either. But when you're in there, you were in there, weren't you? When you were there with.
I have to ask you a question about that. What is the low frequency, seems like a warble that you hear, or you almost feel it, it's almost subsonic. What is that sound inside that room?
Well, actually, almost certainly, it's the result, maybe it's even people breathing, but all of those so-called relieving chambers above the King's Chamber, the 70-ton blocks are not relieving chambers. They don't relieve anything. They're not roll-aids. They are resonating chambers, and for whatever reason, resonance plays a major role in that pyramid and in certain other pyramids as well. Why? We don't know. Maybe it's star energies that they're capturing because they have those star shafts that point at certain stars. Maybe rituals of some sort went on there. If you chant, if you set up a chant in the King's Chamber, and you have somebody way down, hundreds of feet below in the pit, which goes around a whole bunch of different corners, you can hear the sound down in the pit. That's another part of John theory that we don't have time for now. And anyway, it wouldn't make any sense unless you're there. But part, that pyramid is a resonant structure. Resonance plays, for whatever reason, a major role in that very careful construction, but I don't know, and nobody really knows specifically why they did it that way, but for some damn good reason, because you don't go tossing around five different layers of 70-ton blocks if you don't know what you're doing. And you don't need it for the architecturally strengthening the structure, because the Queen's Chamber, which is below it and has more weight on it, is supported by simply a simple gabled roof. So,
very interesting.
But it's that effect that you get, that resonant effect, you may be just hearing it might be the wind outside or something like that. But yes, when you're inside there, it's totally still. And if you're hearing something, a rumbling or something like that, it may even be the wind, or it may be just people's heartbeats or breaths or something like that. Yeah, it's an amazing place.
Now, what do you make of the phenomenon known as orbs? I noticed lots and lots of people flashing pictures incessantly in the dark, trying to capture these elusive little spheres of light.
Yeah, well, they come up all the time on digital photography, and you know, the skeptics all say, oh, it's dust on the lens, but it's not dust on the lens, because people take another picture another 2 minutes later somewhere, and they don't get the orbs. I don't know. There are whole conferences on this now. I think there's something about the digital technology is able to capture on, with the camera, like energy balls. Yeah, because I'm not a photographer, but, I mean, sometimes, and in certain places, people get it looks like they're in a bubble bath. And in other places, 2 feet away, you don't get it at all. It's very strange.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
But I think in some way or another, it's their little energy packets that the camera's able to catch. And you don't get it on regular film, which nobody uses anymore.
That's true. Wow. Fascinating stuff. Okay, you got a deal. I'll put a banner on the website, and we'll see if we can put together a November tour with John Anthony West. His website is jawest.net, and it has been our pleasure. Gosh, I can't believe 3 hours has gone already. My gosh.
Well, it hasn't. It's 2 hours and three quarters.
Yeah, I know, but we have to end at a quarter till in order to
get
the next host to come up and people to stage their commercials and all of that.
Right.
It's absolutely been my pleasure to have you on the program.
And mine to be on, Brooks. Thank you.
Oh, I will get emails from this, I can guarantee you. This program will be available in the next couple of days at x2-radio.com, or you can listen to it at bbsradio.com. And, John, you and I will be in contact after the program sometime.
Well, let's hope it works. It'll be fun traveling with you and X-Square people to Egypt. Let's see what happens.
Sounds like fun. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Brooks.
Evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, there you have it, X-Squared Radio listeners, Earth Explorers all. We are so happy to have you here on the program with us. And we'll be along next week. Don't forget, we have other guests coming up later in the month. And you never know who's going to come on X-Squared Radio. We are exploring the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth right here.
It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.
Mm-hmm. Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.